Toes are just barely touching the ground. She can feel his cool nose against her temple and his hot breath coming into one ear. It sends a tingle straight down to her toes.
Short-term goal or long-term goal? Raven whispers.
Long-term.
I used to have this plan. I was going to nuke America.
Oh, well, that'd be kind of harsh, she says.
Maybe. Depends on what kind of mood I'm in. Other than that, no long-term goals.
Every time he whispers something, another breath tickles her ear. How about medium-term, then?
In a few hours, the raft comes apart, Raven says. We're headed for California, looking for a decent place to live. Some people might try to stop us. It's my job to help the people make it safe and sound up onto the shore. So you might say, I'm going to war.
Oh, that's a shame, she mumbles.
So it's hard to think of anything besides the here and now.
Yeah, I know.
I rented a nice room to spend my last night in, Raven says. It's got clean sheets.
Not for long, she thinks.
She had thought that his lips would be cold and stiff, like a fish. But she's shocked at how warm they are. Every part of his body feels hot, like that's his only way of keeping warm up in the Arctic. About 30 seconds into the kiss, he bends down, wraps his great thigh-sized forearms around her waist, cinches her up into the air, lifting her feet up off the deck. She was afraid he would take her to some horrible place, but it turns out he rented a whole shipping container, stacked way up high on one of the container ships in the core. The place is like a luxury hotel for big core wheels. She's trying to decide what to do with her legs, which are now dangling uselessly. She's not quite ready to wrap them around him, not this early in the date. Then she feels them spreading apart, way, way apart. Raven's thighs must be bigger around than his waist. He has lifted one leg up into her crotch and put the foot up on a chair, so she's straddling his thigh. And with his arms, he's holding her body up against him, squeezing and relaxing, squeezing and relaxing, so that she's helplessly rocking back and forth, all her weight on her crotch. Some huge muscle, the upmost part of his quadricep, angles up where it attaches to the bone in his pelvis. And as he rocks her in closer and tighter, she ends up straddling that, shoved against it so tight that she can feel the seams in the crotch of her coverall, feel the coins in the key pocket of Raven's black jeans. When he slides his hands downward, still pressing her inward, and squeezes her butt in both hands, so big it must be like squeezing an apricot, fingers so long they wrap around and push up into her crack, and she rocks forward to get away from it, but there's nowhere to go except into his body. Her face breaking away from the kiss and sliding against the perspiration of his broad, smooth, whiskerless neck. She can't help letting out a yelp that turns into a moan, and then she knows he's got her. Because she never makes noises during sex, but this time, she can't help it. And once she's decided that, she's impatient to get on with it. She can move her arms, she can move her legs, but the middle part of her body is pinned in place. It's not going to move until Raven moves it. And he's not going to move it until she makes him want to. So she goes to work on his ear. That usually does it. He tries to get away from her. Raven, trying to run away from something. She likes that idea. She has arms that are as strong as a man's, strong from hanging on to that poon on the freeway. So she wraps them around his head like a vice and presses her forehead against the side of his head and starts orbiting the tip of her tongue around the little folded over rim of his outer ear. He stands paralyzed for a couple of minutes, breathing shallowly, while she works her way inward. And when she finally shoves her tongue into his ear canal,
He bucks and grunts like he's just been harpooned, lifts her up off his leg, kicks the chair across the room so hard it cracks against the steel wall of the shipping container. She feels herself falling backward toward the futon, thinks for a moment she's about to get crushed beneath him, but he catches all the weight on his elbows, except for his lower body, which slams into hers all at once, sending another electric shot of pleasure up her back and down her legs. Her thighs and calves have turned solid and tight, like they've been pumped full of juice. She can't relax them. He leans up on one elbow, separating their bodies for a moment, plants his mouth on hers to maintain the contact, fills her mouth with his tongue, holds her there with it while he one-hands the fastener at the collar of her coverall and yanks the zipper all the way down to the crotch. It's open now, exposing a broad V of skin converging from her shoulders. He rolls back onto her, grabs the top of the coverall with both hands, and pulls it down behind her, forcing her arms down and to her sides, stuffing the mass of fabric and pads down underneath the small of her back so she stays arched up toward him. Then he's in between her tight thighs, all those skating muscles strained to the limit, and his hands come back inside to squeeze her butt again, this time his hot skin against hers. It's like sitting on a warm buttered griddle. Makes the whole body feel warmer. There's something she's supposed to remember at this point. Something she has to take care of. Something important. One of those dreary duties that always seems so logical when you think about it in the abstract, and, at moments like this, seems so utterly beside the point that it never even occurs to you. It must be something to do with birth control, or something like that. But YT is helpless with passion, so she has an excuse. So she squirms and kicks her knees until the coverall and her panties have slid down to her ankles. Raven gets completely naked in about 3 seconds. He pulls his shirt off over his head and throws it somewhere, bucks out of his pants and kicks them off onto the floor. His skin is as smooth as hers, like the skin of a mammal that swims through the sea, but he feels hot, not cold and fishy. She doesn't see his cock, but she doesn't want to. What's the point, right? She does something she's never done before. Comes as soon as he goes into her. It's like a bolt of lightning shoots out from the middle, down the backs of her tensed legs, up her spine, into her nipples. She sucks in air until her whole rib cage is poking out through the skin and then screams it all out. She just rips one. Raven's probably deaf now, which is his fucking problem. She goes limp. So does he. He must have come at the same time. Which is okay. It's early, and poor Raven was horny as a goat from being out to sea. Later on, she'll expect more endurance. Right now, she's content to lie underneath him and suck the warmth out of his body. She's been cold for days. Her feet are still cold, hanging out in the air. But that just makes the rest of her feel much better. Raven seems content too, uncharacteristically so. Talk about bliss. Most guys would already be flipping through channels on the TV. Not Raven. He's content to lie here all night, breathing softly into her neck. As a matter of fact, he's gone to sleep right on top of her, like something a woman would do. She dozes too. Lies there for a minute or two, all these thoughts going through her head. This is a pretty nice place, like a mid-priced business hotel in the valley. She never figured anything like this existed on the raft. But there's rich people and poor people here too, just like anywhere else. When they came to a certain place on the walkway, not far from the first of the big core ships, there was an armed guard blocking the way. He let Raven go on through, and Raven took YT with him, leading her by the hand, and the guard gave her a look, but he didn't say anything. He was keeping most of his attention on Raven. After that, the walkway got a lot nicer. It was broad, like the boardwalk at the beach, and not quite so crowded with old Chinese ladies carrying gigantic bundles on their backs. And it didn't smell like shit quite so much. When they got to the first core ship, there was a stairway that took them from sea level up to its deck. From there, they took a gangplank across to the innards of another ship, and Raven led her through the place like he'd been through it a million times, and eventually they crossed another gangplank into this container ship. And it was just like a fucking hotel in there. Bellhops with white gloves carrying luggage for guys in suits, a registration desk, everything. It was still a ship. Everything's made out of steel that has been painted white a million times over, but nothing like what she expected. There's even a little helipad where the suits can come and go. There's a chopper parked next to it with a logo she's seen before. Rife Advanced Research Enterprises. Rare. The people who gave her the envelope to deliver to EBGOC headquarters. All of this is fitting together now. The feds, and L. Bob Rife, and the Reverend Wayne's pearly gates, and the raft are all part of the same deal. "Who the hell are all these people?" she asked Raven when she first saw it. But he just shushed her. She asked him again later as they were wandering around looking for their room, and he told her, "These guys all work for L. Bob Rife. Programmers and engineers and communications people. Rife's an important man. Got a monopoly to run." "Rife's here?" she asked him, putting on an act, of course. She had it figured out by that point. "Shh," he said. "It's a nice piece of intel. Hero should like it, if she can just get it to him. And even that's going to be easy. She never thought there'd be metaverse terminals here on the raft. But on this ship, there's a whole row of them, so that visiting suits can call back to civilization. All she has to do is get to one without waking up Raven. Which could be tricky. It's too bad she couldn't drug him with something, like in the raft movies." That's when the realization comes. It swims up out of her subconscious in the same way that a nightmare does. Or when you leave the house and remember half an hour later that you left a tea kettle going on the stove. It's a cold, clammy reality that she can't do a damn thing about. She has finally remembered what that nagging thing was that bothered her for a moment, right before the actual moment of fucking. It was not birth control. It was not a hygiene thing. It was her dentata, the last line of personal self-defense. Along with Uncle Enzo's dog tags, the one piece of stuff that the orthos didn't take. They didn't take it because they don't believe in cavity searches. Which means that at the moment Raven entered her, a very small hypodermic needle slipped imperceptibly into the engorged frontal vein of his penis, automatically shooting a cocktail of powerful narcotics and depressants into his bloodstream. Raven's been harpooned in the place where he least expected it. Now he's going to sleep for at least 4 hours. And then, boy, is he ever going to be pissed?
Hero remembers Elliot's warning. Don't go onto the raft itself without a local guide. This kid must be a refugee that Bruce Lee recruited from some Filipino neighborhood on the raft. The kid's name is Transubstanciacion, Tranny for short. He climbs into the Zodiac before Hero tells him to. "Wait a sec," Hero says. "We have to do some packing first." Hero risks turning on a small flashlight, uses it to rummage around the yacht, picking up valuable stuff. A few bottles of presumably drinkable water, some food, extra ammunition for his nine. He takes one of the grappling hooks too, coiling its rope neatly. Seems like the kind of thing that might be useful on the raft. He has one other chore to take care of, not something he's looking forward to. Hero has lived in a lot of places where mice and even rats were a problem. He used to get rid of them using traps. But then he had a run of bad luck with the things. He would hear a trap snap shut in the middle of the night, and then instead of silence, he would hear pitiable squeaking and thrashing, whacking noises as the stricken rodent tried to drag itself back to safety with a trap snapped over some part of its anatomy, usually its head. When you've gotten up at 3 a.m. to find a live mouse on your kitchen counter leaving a contrail of brain tissue across the formica, it is hard to get back to sleep, and so he prefers to set out poison now. Somewhat in the same vein, a severely wounded man, the last man Hiro shot, is thrashing around on the deck of the yacht, up near the bow, babbling. More than anything he has ever wanted to do, Hiro wants to get into the Zodiac and get away from this person. He knows that in order to go up and help him, or put him out of his misery, he's going to have to shine the flashlight on him, and when he does that, he's going to see something he'll never be able to forget. But he has to do it. He swallows a couple of times because he's already gagging, and follows his flashlight beam up to the bow. It's much worse than he had expected. This man apparently took a bullet somewhere around the bridge of his nose, aimed upward. Everything above that point has been pretty much blown off. Hiro's looking into a cross-section of his lower brain. Something is sticking up out of his head. Hiro figures it must be fragments of skull or something, but it's too smooth and regular for that. Now that he's gotten over his initial nausea, he's finding this easier to look at. It helps to know that the guy is out of his misery. More than half of his brain is gone. He's still talking. His voice sounds whistly and gaseous, like a pipe organ gone bad because of the changes in his skull. But it's just a brainstem function, just a twitch in the vocal cords. The thing sticking up out of his head is a whip antenna about a foot long. It is encased in black rubber, like the antennas on cop walkie-talkies, and it is strapped onto his head above the left ear. This is one of the antenna heads that Elliot warned them about. Hiro grabs the antenna and pulls. He might as well take the headset with him. It must have something to do with the way El Bob Reif controls the raft. It doesn't come off. When Hiro pulls, what's left of the guy's head twists around, but the antenna doesn't come loose. And that's how Hiro figures out that this isn't a headset at all. The antenna has been permanently grafted onto the base of the man's skull. Hiro switches his goggles into millimeter wave radar and stares into the man's ruined head. The antenna is attached to the skull by means of short screws that go into the bone, but do not pierce all the way through. The base of the antenna contains a few microchips, whose purpose Hiro cannot divine by looking at them. But nowadays, you can put a supercomputer on a single chip, so anytime you see more than one chip together in one place, you're looking at significant wear. A single hair-thin wire emerges from the base of the antenna and penetrates the skull. It passes straight through to the brainstem and then branches and rebranches into a network of invisibly tiny wires embedded in the brain tissue, coiled around the base of the tree. Which explains why this guy continues to pump out a steady stream of raft babble, even when his brain is missing. It looks like El Bob Reif has figured out a way to make electrical contact with the part of the brain where Asherah lives. These words aren't originating here. It's a Pentecostal radio broadcast coming through on his antenna. Reason is still up top, its monitor screen radiating blue static toward heaven. Hiro finds the hard power switch and turns it off. Computers this powerful are supposed to shut themselves down after you've asked them to. Turning one off with the hard switch is like lulling someone to sleep by severing their spinal column. But when the system is snow-crashed, it loses even the ability to turn itself off, and primitive methods are required. Hiro packs the Gatling gun assembly back into the case and latches it shut. Maybe it's not as heavy as he thought, or maybe he's on adrenaline overdrive. Then he realizes why it seems so much lighter. Most of its weight was ammunition, and fisheye used up quite a bit. He half carries, half drags it back to the stern, making sure the heat exchanger stays in the water, and somersaults it into the Zodiac. Hiro climbs in after it, joining Tranny, and starts attending to the motor.
"No motor," Tranny says. "It snagged bad."
Right. The spiderweb would get wrapped around the propeller. Tranny shows Hiro how to snap the Zodiac's oars into the oarlocks. Hiro rows for a while and finds himself in a long, clear zone that zigzags its way through the raft, like a lead of clear water between ice floes and the Arctic.
Motor okay,
Tranny says. He drops the motor into the water. Tranny pumps up the fuel line and starts it up. It starts on the first pull. Bruce Lee ran a tight ship. As Hero begins to motor down the open space, he is afraid that it is just a little cove in the ghetto. But this is just a trick of the lights. He rounds a corner and finds it stretching out for some distance. It is a sort of beltway that runs all the way around the raft. Small streets and even smaller alleys lead from this beltway into the various ghettos. Through the scope, Hero can see that their entrances are guarded. Anyone's free to cruise around the beltway, but people are more protective of their neighborhoods. The worst thing that can happen on the raft is for your neighborhood to get cut loose. That's why the raft is such a tangled mess. Each neighborhood is afraid that the neighboring hoods are going to gang up on them, cut them loose, leave them to starve in the middle of the Pacific. So they are constantly finding new ways to tie themselves into each other, running cables over, under, and around their neighbors, tying into more far-flung hoods, or preferably, into one of the core ships. The neighborhood guards are armed, needless to say. Looks like the weapon of choice is a small Chinese knockoff of the AK-47. Its metal frame jumps out pretty clearly on radar. The Chinese government must have stamped out an unimaginable number of these things back in the days when they spent a lot of time thinking about the possibility of fighting a land war with the Soviets. Most of them just look like indolent third-world militia the world over. But at the entrance to one neighborhood, Hero sees that the guard in charge has a whip antenna sticking straight up in the air, sprouting from his head. A few minutes later, they get to a point where the beltway is intersected by a broad street that runs straight into the middle of the raft, where the big ships are, the core. The closest one is a Nipponese container ship, a low flat deck number with a high bridge, stacked with steel shipping containers. It's webbed over with rope ladders and makeshift stairways that enable people to climb up into this container or that. Many of the containers have lights burning in them.
Apartment building,
Tranny jokes, noting Hero's interest. Then he shakes his head and rolls his eyes and rubs his thumb against his fingertips. Apparently, this is quite the swell neighborhood. The nice part of the cruise comes to an end when they notice several fast skiffs emerging from a dark and smoky neighborhood.
Vietnam gang, Tranny says.
He puts his hand on Hero's and gently but firmly removes it from the outboard motor's throttle. Hero checks them out on radar. A couple of these guys have the little AK-47s, but most of them are armed with knives and pistols, obviously looking forward to some close-up face-to-face contact. These guys in the boats are, of course, the peons. More important-looking gents stand along the edge of the neighborhood, smoking and watching. A couple of them are wireheads. Tranny revs it up, turns into a sparse neighborhood of loosely connected Arabian dhows, and maneuvers through the darkness for a while, occasionally putting his hand on Hero's head and gently pressing it down so he doesn't catch a rope with his neck. When they emerge from the fleet of dhows, the Vietnamese gang is no longer in evidence. If this happened in daylight, the gangsters could track them by following Reason's steam. Tranny steers them across a medium-sized street and into a cluster of fishing boats. In the middle of this area, an old trawler sits, being cut up for scrap, cutting torches illuminating the black surface of the water all around. But most of the work is being done with hammers and cold chisels, which radiate appalling noise across the flat, echoing water. Home, Tranny says, smiling, and points to a couple of houseboats lashed together. Lights are still burning here. A couple of guys are out on the deck smoking fat makeshift cigars. Through the windows, they can see a couple of women working in the kitchen. As they approach, the guys on the deck sit up, take notice, draw revolvers out of their waistbands. But then Tranny speaks up in a happy stream of Tagalog, and everything changes. Tranny gets the full prodigal son welcome. Crying, hysterical fat ladies, a swarm of little kids piling out of their hammocks, sucking their thumbs and jumping up and down. Older men beaming, showing great gaps and black splotches in their smiles, watching and nodding and diving in to give him the occasional hug. And on the edge of the mob, way back in the darkness,
is another wirehead.
You come in too,
says one of the women, a lady in her 40s named Eunice.
That's okay, Hero says. I won't intrude.
This statement is translated and moves like a wave through the some 896 Filipinos who have now converged on the area. It is greeted with the utmost shock. Intrude? Unthinkable! Nonsense! How dare you so insult us? One of the gap-toothed guys, a miniature old man and probable World War II veteran, jumps onto the rocking Zodiac, sticks to the floor like a gecko, wraps his arm around Hiro's shoulders, and pokes a spliff into his mouth. He looks like a solid guy. Hiro leans into him.
Compadre, who is the guy with the antenna? A friend of yours?
Nah, the guy whispers. He's an asshole.
Then he puts his index finger dramatically to his lips and shushes. It's all in the eyes. Along with picking handcuffs, vaulting jersey barriers, and fending off perverts, it is one of the quintessential courier skills. Walking around in a place where you don't belong without attracting suspicion. And you do it by not looking at anyone. Keep those eyes straight ahead no matter what. Don't open them too wide. Don't look tense. That, and the fact that she just came in here with a guy that everyone is scared of, gets her back through the container ship to the reception area. I need to use a street terminal, she says to the reception guy. Can you charge it to my room?
Yes, ma'am, the reception guy says.
He doesn't have to ask which room she's in. He's all smiles, all respect. Not the kind of thing you get very often when you're a courier. She could really get to like this relationship with Raven, if it weren't for the fact that he's a homicidal mutant. Hiro ducks out of Tranny's celebratory dinner rather early, drags Reason off the Zodiac and onto the front porch of the houseboat, opens it up, and jacks his personal computer into its BIOS. Reason reboots with no problems. That's to be expected. It's also to be expected that later, probably when he most needs Reason to work, it will crash again, the way it did for Fisheye. He could keep turning it off and on every time it does this, but this is awkward in the heat of battle, and not the type of solution that hackers admire. It would be much more sensible just to debug it, which he could do by hand if he had time. But there may be a better way of going about it. It's possible that by now, Ing Security Industries has fixed the bug, come out with a new version of the software. If so, he should be able to get a copy of it on the street. Hiro materializes in his office. The librarian pokes his head out of the next room, just in case Hiro has any questions for him.
What does Ultima Ratio Regum mean?
The last argument of kings, the librarian says. King Louis XIV had it stamped onto the barrels of all the cannons that were forged during his reign.
Hiro stands up and walks out into his garden. His motorcycle is waiting for him on the gravel path that leads to the gate. Looking up over the fence, Hiro can see the lights of downtown rising in the distance again. His computer has succeeded in jacking into L. Bob Reif's global network. He has access to the street. This is as Hiro had expected. Reif must have a whole suite of satellite uplinks there on the Enterprise, patched into a cellular network covering the raft. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to reach the metaverse from his very own watery fortress, which would never do for a man like Reif. Hiro climbs on his bike, eases it through the neighborhood and onto the street, and then gooses it up to a few hundred miles an hour, slaloming between the stanchions of the monorail, practicing. He runs into a few of them and stops, but that's to be expected. Ing Security Industries has a whole floor of a mile-high neon skyscraper near Port 1, right in the middle of downtown. Like everything else in the metaverse, it's open 24 hours because it's always business hours somewhere in the world. Hiro leaves his bike on the street,
takes the elevator up to the 397th floor and comes face to face with a receptionist demon. For a moment, he can't peg her racial background. Then he realizes that this demon is half black, half Asian, just like him. If a white man had stepped off the elevator, she probably would have been a blonde. A Nipponese businessman would have come face to face with a perky Nipponese office girl.
"Yes, sir," she says. "Is this in regard to sales or customer service?"
"Customer service."
"Whom are you with?"
"You name it, I'm with them."
"I'm sorry."
Like human receptionists, the demon is especially bad at handling irony. "At the moment, I think I'm working for the Central Intelligence Corporation, the Mafia, and Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong."
"I see," says the receptionist, making a note.
Also like a human receptionist, it is not possible to impress her.
"And what product is this in regards to?"
"Reason."
"Sir, welcome to Ing Security Industries,"
says another voice. It is another demon, an attractive black Asian woman in highly professional dress who has materialized from the depths of the office suite. She ushers Hiro down a long, nicely paneled hallway, down another long paneled hallway, and then down a long paneled hallway. Every few steps, he passes by a reception area where avatars from all over the world sit in chairs passing the time. But Hiro doesn't have to wait. She ushers him straight into a nice big paneled office where an Asian man sits behind a desk littered with models of helicopters. It is Mr. Ing himself. He stands up. They swap bows. The usher lady checks out.
"You working with Fisheye?"
Ing says, lighting up a cig. The smoke swirls in the air ostentatiously. It takes as much computing power realistically to model the smoke coming out of Ing's mouth as it does to model the weather system of the entire planet.
"He's dead," Hiro says. "Reason crashed at a critical juncture, and he ate a harpoon."
Ing doesn't react. Instead, he just sits there motionless for a few seconds, absorbing this data, as if his customers get harpooned all the time. He's probably got a mental database of everyone who has ever used one of his toys and what happened to them.
"I told him it was a beta version," Ing says, "and he should have known not to use it for infighting. A $2 switchblade would have served him better."
"Agreed. But he was quite taken with it."
Ing blows out more smoke, thinking,
"As we learned in Vietnam, high-powered weapons are so sensorily overwhelming that they are similar to psychoactive drugs. Like LSD, which can convince people they can fly, causing them to jump out of windows. Weapons can make people overconfident, skewing their tactical judgment, as in the case of Fisheye."
"I'll be sure and remember that," Hiro says.
"What kind of combat environment do you want to use Reason in?"
Ing says.
"I need to take over an aircraft carrier tomorrow morning."
"The Enterprise?"
"Yes."
"You know," Ing says, apparently in a conversational mood, "there's a guy who actually took over a nuclear missile submarine armed with nothing more than a piece of glass."
"Yeah, that's the guy who killed Fisheye. I might have to tangle with him, too."
Ing laughs.
"What is your ultimate objective? As you know, we are all in this together, so you may share your thoughts with me."
"I'd prefer a little more discretion in this case."
"Too late for that, Hiro," says another voice.
Hiro turns around. It is Uncle Enzo being ushered through the door by the receptionist, a striking Italian woman. Just a few paces behind him is a small Asian businessman and an Asian receptionist.
"I took the liberty of calling them in when you arrived," Ing says, "so that we could have a powwow."
"Pleasure,"
Uncle Enzo says, bowing slightly to Hiro. Hiro bows back.
"I'm really sorry about the car, sir."
"It's forgotten,"
Uncle Enzo says. The small Asian man has now come into the room. Hiro finally recognizes him. It is the photo that is on the wall of every Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong in the world. Introductions and bows all around. Suddenly, a number of extra chairs have materialized in the office, so everyone pulls one up. Ing comes out from behind his desk, and they sit in a circle.
Let's cut to the chase, since I assume that your situation, Hero, may be more precarious than ours,
Uncle Enzo says. You got that right, sir.
We would all like to know what the hell is going on, Mr. Lee says. His English is almost devoid of a Chinese accent. Clearly his cute, daffy public image is just a front.
How much of this have you guys figured out so far?
Bits and pieces, Uncle Enzo says. How much have you figured out?
Almost all of it, Hero says. Once I talk to Juanita, I'll have the rest.
In that case, you are in possession of some very valuable intel, Uncle Enzo says.
He reaches into his pocket and pulls out a hypercard and hands it toward Hero. It says, 25 million Hong Kong dollars. Hero reaches out and takes the card. Somewhere on Earth, two computers swap bursts of electronic noise and the money gets transferred from the Mafia's account to Hero's.
You'll take care of the split with YT, Uncle Enzo says.
Hero nods. You bet I will.
I'm here on the raft looking for a piece of software, a piece of medicine, to be specific, that was written 5,000 years ago by a Sumerian personage named Enki, a neurolinguistic hacker.
What does that mean? Mr. Lee says.
It means a person who is capable of programming other people's minds with verbal streams of data, known as namshubs. Ing is totally expressionless. He takes another drag on his cigarette, spouts the smoke up above his head in a geyser, watches it spread out against the ceiling.
What is the mechanism?
We've got two kinds of language in our heads. The kind we're using now is acquired. It patterns our brains as we're learning it. But there's also a tongue that's based in the deep structures of the brain that everyone shares. These structures consist of basic neural circuits that have to exist in order to allow our brains to acquire higher languages.
Linguistic infrastructure, Uncle Enzo says.
Yeah. I guess deep structure and infrastructure mean the same thing. Anyway, we can access those parts of the brain under the right conditions.
Glossolalia, speaking in tongues, is the output side of it, where the deep linguistic structures hook into our tongues and speak, bypassing all the higher acquired languages. Everyone's known that for some time.
You're saying there's an input side too?
Ing says. Exactly. It works in reverse. Under the right conditions, your ears, or eyes, can tie into the deep structures, bypassing the higher language functions. Which is to say, someone who knows the right words can speak words or show you visual symbols that go past all your defenses and sink right into your brainstem. Like a cracker who breaks into a computer system, bypasses all the security precautions, and plugs himself into the core, enabling him to exert absolute control over the machine.
In that situation, the people who own the computer are helpless,
Ing says.
Right, because they access the machine at a higher level which has now been overridden.
In the same sense, once a neurolinguistic hacker plugs into the deep structures of our brain, we can't get him out, because we can't even control our own brain at such a basic level.
What does this have to do with a clay tablet on the Enterprise?
Mr. Lee says.
Bear with me. This language, the mother tongue, is a vestige of an earlier phase of human social development. Primitive societies were controlled by verbal rules called mei. The mei were like little programs for humans. They were a necessary part of the transition from caveman society to an organized agricultural society. For example, there was a program for plowing a furrow in the ground and planting grain. There was a program for baking bread and another one for making a house. There were also mei for higher-level functions, such as war, diplomacy, and religious ritual. All the skills required to operate a self-sustaining culture were contained in these mei, which were written down on tablets or passed around in an oral tradition. In any case, the repository for the mei was the local temple, which was a database of mei controlled by a priest-king called an en. When someone needed bread, They would go to the N, or one of his underlings, and download the bread-making Mei from the temple. Then they would carry out the instructions, run the program, and when they were finished, they'd have a loaf of bread. A central database was necessary, among other reasons, because some of the Mei had to be properly timed. If people carried out the plowing and planting Mei at the wrong time of the year, the harvest would fail and everyone would starve. The only way to make sure that the Mei were properly timed was to build astronomical observatories to watch the skies for the change of season. So the Sumerians built towers with their tops with the heavens, topped with astronomical diagrams. The N would watch the skies and dispense the agricultural Mei at the proper times of year to keep the economy running.
I think you have a chicken and egg problem, Uncle Enzo says. How did such a society first come to be organized?
There is an informational entity known as the metavirus, which causes information systems to infect themselves with customized viruses. This may be just a basic principle of nature, like Darwinian selection, or it may be an actual piece of information that floats around the universe on comets and radio waves. I'm not sure. In any case, what it comes down to is this. Any information system of sufficient complexity will inevitably become infected with viruses, viruses generated from within itself. At some point in the distant past, the metavirus infected the human race and has been with us ever since. The first thing it did was to spawn a whole Pandora's box of DNA viruses, smallpox, influenza, and so on. Health and longevity became a thing of the past. A distant memory of this event is preserved in Legends of the Fall from Paradise, in which mankind was ejected from a life of ease into a world infested with disease and pain. That plague eventually reached some kind of a plateau. We still see new DNA viruses from time to time, but it seems that our bodies have developed a resistance to DNA viruses in general.
Perhaps, Ng says, there are only so many viruses that will work in the human DNA, and the metavirus has created all of them.
Could be. Anyway, Sumerian culture, the society based on Mei, was another manifestation of the metavirus, except that in this case, it was in a linguistic form rather than DNA.
Excuse me, Mr. Lee says. You are saying that civilization started out as an infection?
Civilization in its primitive form, yes. Each Mei was a sort of virus kicked out by the metavirus principle. Take the example of the bread-baking Mei. Once that Mei got into society, it was a self-sustaining piece of information. It's a simple question of natural selection. People who know how to bake bread will live better and be more apt to reproduce than people who don't know how. Naturally, they will spread the Mei, acting as hosts for this self-replicating piece of information. That makes it a virus. Sumerian culture, with its temples full of Mei, was just a collection of successful viruses that had accumulated over the millennia. It was a franchise operation, except it had ziggurats instead of golden arches and clay tablets instead of three-ring binders. The Sumerian word for mind or wisdom is identical to the word for ear. That's all those people were, ears with bodies attached, passive receivers of information. But Enki was different. Enki was an N who just happened to be especially good at his job. He had the unusual ability to write new Mei. He was a hacker. He was actually the first modern man, a fully conscious human being just like us. At some point, Enki realized that Sumer was stuck in a rut. People were carrying out the same old Mei all the time, not coming up with new ones, not thinking for themselves. I suspect that he was lonely, being one of the few, perhaps the only, conscious human being in the world. He realized that in order for the human race to advance, they had to be delivered from the grip of this viral civilization. So he created the Namshub of Enki, a countervirus that spread along the same routes as the Mei and the metavirus. It went into the deep structures of the brain and reprogrammed them. Henceforth,
no one could understand the Sumerian language or any other deep structure-based language. Cut off from our common deep structures, we began to develop new languages that had nothing in common with each other. The Mae no longer worked, and it was not possible to write new Mae. Further transmission of the metavirus was blocked.
Why didn't everyone starve from lack of bread, having lost the bread-making Mae?
Uncle Enzo says. Some probably did. Everyone else had to use their higher brains and figure it out. So you might say that the Namshub of Enki was the beginnings of human consciousness, when we first had to think for ourselves. It was the beginning of rational religion, too, the first time that people began to think about abstract issues like God and good and evil. That's where the name Babel comes from. Literally, it means Gate of God. It was the gate that allowed God to reach the human race. Babel is a gateway in our minds, a gateway that was opened by the Namshub of Enki that broke us free from the metavirus and gave us the ability to think. Moved us from a materialistic world to a dualistic world, a binary world, with both a physical and a spiritual component. There was probably chaos and upheaval. Enki, or his son Marduk, tried to reimpose order on society by supplanting the old system of Mae with a code of laws, the Code of Hammurabi. It was partially successful. Asherah worship continued in many places, though. It was an incredibly tenacious cult, a throwback to Sumer, that spread itself both verbally and through the exchange of bodily fluids. They had cult prostitutes, and they also adopted orphans and spread the virus to them via breast milk. Wait a minute, Ing says. Now you are talking about a biological virus again. Exactly. That's the whole point of Asherah. It's both. As an example, look at herpes simplex. Herpes heads straight for the nervous system when it enters the body. Some strains stay in the peripheral nervous system, but other strains head like a bullet for the central nervous system and take a permanent residence in the cells of the brain, coiling around the brainstem like a serpent around a tree. The Asherah virus, which may be related to herpes, or they may be one and the same, passes through the cell walls and goes to the nucleus and messes with the cell's DNA in the same way that steroids do. But Asherah is a lot more complicated than a steroid.
And when it alters that DNA, what is the result?
No one has studied it, except maybe for L. Bob Reif. I think it definitely brings the mother tongue closer to the surface, makes people more apt to speak in tongues and more susceptible to Mae. I would guess that it also tends to encourage irrational behavior, maybe lowers the victim's defenses to viral ideas, makes them sexually promiscuous, perhaps all of the above.
Does every viral idea have a biological virus counterpart?
Uncle Enzo says. No, only Asherah does, as far as I know. That is why, of all the Mae and all the gods and religious practices that predominated in Sumer, only Asherah is still going strong today. A viral idea can be stamped out, as happened with Nazism, bell-bottoms, and Bart Simpson t-shirts, but Asherah, because it has a biological aspect, can remain latent in the human body. After Babel, Asherah was still resident in the human brain, being passed on from mother to child and from lover to lover. We are all susceptible to the pull of viral ideas, like mass hysteria, or a tune that gets into your head that you keep on humming all day until you spread it to someone else. Jokes, urban legends, crackpot religions, Marxism. No matter how smart we get, there is always this deep irrational part that makes us potential hosts for self-replicating information. But being physically infected with the virulent strain of the Asherah virus makes you a whole lot more susceptible. The only thing that keeps these things from taking over the world is the Babel factor. The walls of mutual incomprehension that compartmentalize the human race and stop the spread of viruses. Babel led to an explosion in the number of languages. That was part of Enki's plan. Monocultures, like a field of corn, are susceptible to infections,
but genetically diverse cultures, like a prairie, are extremely robust. After a few thousand years, one new language developed, Hebrew, that possessed exceptional flexibility and power. The Deuteronomists, a group of radical monotheists in the 6th and 7th centuries BC, were the first to take advantage of it. They lived in a time of extreme nationalism and xenophobia, which made it easier for them to reject foreign ideas like Asherah worship. They formalized their old stories into the Torah and implanted within it a law that ensured its propagation throughout history, a law that said, in effect, make an exact copy of me and read it every day. And they encouraged a sort of informational hygiene, a belief in copying things strictly and taking great care with information, which, as they understood, is potentially dangerous. They made data a controlled substance. They may have gone beyond that. There is evidence of carefully planned biological warfare against the army of Sennacherib when he tried to conquer Jerusalem. So the Deuteronomists may have had an N of their very own. Or maybe they just understood viruses well enough that they knew how to take advantage of naturally occurring strains. The skills cultivated by these people were passed down in secret from one generation to the next and manifested themselves 2,000 years later in Europe among the Kabbalistic sorcerers, Baal Shems, masters of the divine name. In any case, this was the birth of rational religion. All of the subsequent monotheistic religions, known by Muslims appropriately as religions of the book, incorporated those ideas to some extent. For example, the Quran states over and over again that it is a transcript, an exact copy of a book in heaven. Naturally, anyone who believes that will not dare to alter the text in any way. Ideas such as these were so effective in preventing the spread of Asherah that eventually every square inch of the territory where the viral cult had once thrived, from India to Spain, was under the sway of Islam, Christianity, or Judaism. But because of its latency, coiled about the brainstem of those it infects, passed from one generation to the next, it always finds ways to resurface. In the case of Judaism, it came in the form of the Pharisees, who imposed a rigid legalistic theocracy on the Hebrews. With its rigid adherence to laws stored in a temple, administered by priestly types vested with civil authority, it resembled the old Sumerian system and was just as stifling. The ministry of Jesus Christ was an effort to break Judaism out of this condition, sort of an echo of what Enki did. Christ's gospel is a new Namshub, an attempt to take religion out of the temple, out of the hands of the priesthood, and bring the kingdom of God to everyone. That is the message explicitly spelled out by his sermons, and it is the message symbolically embodied in the empty tomb. After the crucifixion, the apostles went to his tomb hoping to find his body and instead found nothing. The message was clear enough. We are not to idolize Jesus because his ideas stand alone. His church is no longer centralized in one person, but dispersed among all the people. People who were used to the rigid theocracy of the Pharisees couldn't handle the idea of a popular, non-hierarchical church. They wanted popes and bishops and priests. And so the myth of the resurrection was added onto the Gospels. The message was changed to a form of idolatry. In this new version of the Gospels, Jesus came back to earth and organized a church, which later became the Church of the Eastern and Western Roman Empire, another rigid, brutal, and irrational theocracy. At the same time, the Pentecostal Church was being founded. The early Christians spoke in tongues. The Bible says, "And all were amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, 'What does this mean?'" Well, I think I may be able to answer that question. It was a viral outbreak. Asherah had been present, lurking in the population ever since the triumph of the Deuteronomists. The informational hygiene measures practiced by the Jews kept it suppressed. But in the early days of Christianity, there must have been a lot of chaos, a lot of radicals and freethinkers running around, flouting tradition. Throwbacks to the days of pre-rational religion,
throwbacks to Sumer. And sure enough, they all started talking to each other in the tongue of Eden. The mainline Christian church refused to accept glossolalia. They frowned on it for a few centuries and officially purged it at the Council of Constantinople in 381. The glossolalic cult remained on the fringes of the Christian world. The church was willing to accept a little bit of xenoglossia if it helped convert heathens, as in the case of St. Louis Bertrand, who converted thousands of Indians in the 16th century, spreading glossolalia across the continent faster than smallpox. But as soon as they were converted, those Indians were supposed to shut up and speak Latin like everyone else. The Reformation opened the door a little wider. But Pentecostalism didn't really take off until the year 1900, when a small group of Bible college students in Kansas began to speak in tongues. They spread the practice to Texas. There it became known as the Revival Movement. It spread like wildfire all across the United States and then the world, reaching China and India in 1906. The 20th century's mass media, high literacy rates, and high-speed transportation all served as superb vectors for the infection. In a packed revival hall or a third world refugee encampment, glossolalia spread from one person to the next as fast as panic. By the 80s, the number of Pentecostals worldwide numbered in the tens of millions. And then came television and the Reverend Wayne, backed up by the vast media power of L. Bob Reif. The behavior that the Reverend Wayne promulgates through his television shows, pamphlets, and franchises can be traced in an unbroken line back to the Pentecostal cults of early Christianity, and from there back to pagan glossolalia cults. The cult of Asherah lives. The Reverend Wayne's pearly gates is the cult of Asherah. Lagos figured all of this out. He was originally a researcher at the Library of Congress, later became part of CIC when it absorbed the library. He made a living by discovering interesting things in the library, facts no one else had bothered to dig up. He would organize these facts and sell them to people. Once he figured out all of this Enki Asherah stuff, he went looking for someone who would pay for it and settled on L. Bob Reif, Lord of Bandwidth, owner of the fiber optics monopoly, who at that time employed more programmers than anyone else on Earth. Lagos, typically for a non-businessman, had a fatal flaw. He thought too small. He figured that with a little venture capital, this neurolinguistic hacking could be developed as a new technology that would enable Reif to maintain possession of information that had passed into the brains of his programmers, which, moral considerations aside, wasn't a bad idea. Reif likes to think big. He immediately saw that this idea could be much more powerful. He took Lagos's idea and told Lagos himself to buzz off. Then he started dumping a lot of money into Pentecostal churches. He took a small church in Bayview, Texas, and built it up into a university. He took a small-time preacher, the Reverend Wayne Bedford, and made him more important than the Pope. He constructed a string of self-supporting religious franchises all over the world and used his university and its metaverse campus to crank out tens of thousands of missionaries who fanned out all over the third world and began converting people by the hundreds of thousands, just like St. Louis Bertrand. L. Bob Reif's glossolalia cult is the most successful religion since the creation of Islam. They do a lot of talking about Jesus, but like many self-described Christian churches, it has nothing to do with Christianity, except that they use his name. It's a post-rational religion. Reif also wanted to spread the biological virus as a promoter or enhancer of the cult. But he couldn't really get away with doing that through the use of cult prostitution, because it is flagrantly anti-Christian. But one of the major functions of his third world missionaries was to go out into the hinterlands and vaccinate people. And there was more than just vaccine in those needles. Here in the first world, everyone has already been vaccinated,
and we don't let religious fanatics come up and poke needles into us. But we do take a lot of drugs. So for us, he devised a means for extracting the virus from human blood serum and packaged it as a drug known as